Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. Good to have you all with us here today. On our way to a conversation, we're going to have a very brief look at this day in history and bring a little piece of news that came across the wire that most people are not covering. We want to give you before we start a conversation about Detroit and more. But on this day in history, let's start there. This was a day, actually, in 1960, that Elijah Muhammad, the leader of the Nation of Islam, called for the creation of a black state, a free state in America, at a New York meeting. This is also a day in history that Christopher Columbus in 1498 stumbled onto an island that we now call Trinidad. Thinks he discovered it, but actually there were people living there before he got there. He stumbled into a lot of places that he gets credit for discovering. And this was also the day that civil rights leader Whitney Young was born, on July 31st, 1921, in Lincoln Ridge, Tennessee. This is the day that Duval Patrick was born, first African-American governor of Massachusetts. And actors Wesley Snipes and Lawrence Fishburne were born on this day as well. We'll leave it there for today, our day in history, a little briefer than usual. Let us also tell you about what happened today in California. This has not hit the major news, but I think it's important. We've been covering the hunger strike by prisoners in California who are saying they want an end to solitary confinement in those prisons. Better living and working conditions inside the prisons as well. Because you realize there are people in there who have been in solitary for 10, 20 years. There are over 20,000, 30,000 people, 50,000 people who have been in solitary in California prisons. There's a huge question about human rights issues around solitary. There are 30,000, over 30,000 prisoners in that system now who are on a hunger strike. One of those prisoners died. Bill Garrow Cell, 32 years old. He was found dead 1 week ago, we just found out, at the Corcoran State Prison's Security Housing Unit, a solitary confinement unit. He was on hunger strike along with all the others, and he passed away because of that. People are saying, the Prisoner Hunger Strike Solidarity Coalition announced in a statement saying that the people are outraged at Cell's death, noting it could have been prevented if prison officials had negotiated with the strikers and began talking to people. That hunger strike is still going on. We are going to continue covering that and talking to people in California. Their prison system has said, the California system said, it's irresponsible and inflammatory for hunger strike supporters to say that this inmate, whose death is being investigated as a suicide, died as a result of the hunger strike. The inmate was not participating in a hunger strike, though the other inmates say he was participating in a hunger strike. So we'll leave it there, and we'll continue to cover this in the coming weeks as they continue this hunger strike. We're going to look now at Detroit, and at Detroit in terms of how what happened there, why it happened, but what it means for cities across America, what it means for this nation. My co-host in this hour, this is like a tease to a project that my co-host, Dr. Lester Spence, Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University and our Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence and a Detroit native, came up with an idea that we are pursuing together to get on the air within the next week as a series called Baltimore, Detroit, Oakland, looking at all those three cities and talking to activists and analysts and scholars from those cities on a number of levels. So we're starting today looking at this Detroit piece. Lester, good to have you in the studio with us.
It's good to be here.
We're also joined by Dream Hampton, cultural critic, writer, filmmaker, and feminist, co-author with Jay-Z of the New York Times bestseller Decoded, now working on a new film, which we'll talk about when she comes back next. Dream, good to have you with us again.
Thank you.
And Sheila Garland Olenirin is with us. She's a longtime political activist from Flint, Michigan, an organizer with the National Nurses Union, as her kids say, a political mama with a twinkle in her eye. And Sheila, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And the number here is 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook page. Look for comments there as well, or tweet at Mark Steiner. In Detroit, we see this is the largest municipal default in the history of the United States, $18.5 billion, $7 billion that's secured by collateral from casinos and utility taxes. So that means the major creditors, big banks, will get most of their money, if not all their money, back. But $11 billion or so is unsecured debt, and $9 billion of that dollars is owed to retirees and municipal workers. So those 30,000 former and current workers looks like they're going to be sacrificed. for the needs of 700,000 people who live there now and their progeny. Is that where the fault line really lives? So we're going to talk about that and get our analysis of why this happened. And Dream, let me start with you. And I'd like to go to Dream and Sheila and over to Lester just to talk about your analysis of why you think this is happening and what it means. Dream?
Oh, it's such a long story, but we're definitely looking at corporate welfare. We're looking at, a Tea Party governor, Snyder, masquerading as a fiscally conservative Republican, anti-union, like his brother in Wisconsin, who protects corporate subsidies at the expense of public pensions, public welfare, our safety. You know, we're talking about a state that owes the city of Detroit money, installs an emergency manager, as they have other towns around the state, most of them black, Benton Harbor. Rachel Maddow did a really great piece and kind of tried to ring the alarm about these state takeovers of municipalities. I mean, it's crazy to me that these Tea Party politicians who talk about having this hands-off, less government approach, that's supposed to be their creed and their manifesto, believe that until it comes to taking over cities. So, they're denying us our right to govern by installing an emergency manager, which 82% of the people of Detroit voted against. And they continue to protect their corporate subsidies and corporate welfare. The best evidence of that is the recent Mike Ilitch deal with the city of Detroit, where the taxpayers will be paying for his new $250 million hockey stadium.
After they've already paid for two other stadiums. And Sheila Garland, Sheila Garland, Olenira, I'm sorry.
Olenira, yeah, that's great.
I'm sorry, babe.
That's okay. it's really an honor to be on your show, Mark. This is a really timely topic. I just want to sort of, I'm from Flint, Michigan. I grew up there. My parents were refugees from Arkansas. People are familiar with the huge internal migration of predominantly African Americans off the land that was essentially sort of predicated on the introduction of, motorized farming mechanism, and where before you didn't need droves and droves and droves, you no longer needed droves of folks working in the fields, picking the cotton and doing the farming. And so they fled to the cities for that reason. They were kicked off by the technology on the one hand, but on the other hand, the social conditions and political conditions that existed under Jim Crow in the South at the time. And I think we have to sort of look at what's underpinning, these economic and political moves in big cities like Detroit and in Baltimore and Oakland and indeed around the globe. This is all interconnected. Growing up in Flint, my dad was an auto worker, and I just want to sort of preface it by saying, and I'm not going to take too long, but in the 1980s, we began to see the introduction of essentially laborless technology. Flint was also a thriving, predominantly auto manufacturing center, as was Detroit. And I agree with what Dream is saying, that there is a political agenda on the part of the corporations to take over the assets of these large cities, privatize them, and sell them back if they can to the citizenry. We see this happening in Chicago. I'm currently living in Chicago. With the public schools, there's a tremendous fight. And it's necessary in order to do that to come up with various political schemes in order to make that happen. I mean, the wealthy, the corporations, in the guise of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Commission, and all of these various fronts and tools of the ruling class, have now the political wherewithal to set their own agenda about how they're going to rule the country. The technology, the revolution that's going on in the economy is going to proceed. The capitalists, the corporations have no other recourse but to continue to apply that technology to their corporate production process. The struggle, the thing that faces the majority of us, that is in the working class in this country, black, white, brown, and everything, everyone else in between, is will we have a political agenda that expresses our political interests and that will determine the outcome of this whole thing? And so I just wanted to sort of start off by sort of laying that out from my perspective and my experience.
And Lester, jump in, and also please jump in with your questions and thoughts all through this.
So first, I want to give a shout out to Flint. I've been on the show before and talked about Detroit, and I thought that Detroit was an epicenter, that we'd basically figure out what the 21st century city was supposed to look like from figuring out in Detroit first. It's important to note that what happened to Detroit is predated by what happens to Flint. What's going on probably actually starts in Flint first and moves outward. What I want to briefly do is tackle some of the myths that have been spread about the city, right? So, because you've already got a narrative that has been contested in some places, but is kind of heartening. The first narrative is that that you can plant the roots to Detroit in the 1967 rebellion, which leads to corporate disinvestment and white flight, which then leads to black flight, and then layered on top of that, you've got corruption, particularly at the beginning with Coleman Young, and then near the end with Kwame
Kilpatrick.
and that narrative is empirically wrong and is politically wrong, right? So Detroit's population starts declining as early as the 1960 census, right? In 1950, it was at its peak. I think more than one, maybe two million or so, and then it declines, right? So white flight starts far earlier, and it starts because whites have political access to suburbs. They have the money to move, and the suburbs are almost all racially exclusive. They're all white only, right? So immediately they're looking to establish the white privilege that they formerly had in Detroit before you had a large influx of a black population. So that starts in 1950. By the time 1967, 1970 rolls around, that move has already been, you know, and the same thing with corporate disinvestment. Government gives corporations subsidies to actually move out and establish to decentralize the arsenal of democracy. So you've already got them moving. And then layered on top of that is the fact that by the time 1970, 1980 comes around, the resources that the city used to be able to get from the federal government to deal with this large burgeoning poor, predominantly black population, they can no longer get. So then they're forced to become entrepreneurial. They're forced to be disciplined by bond rating agents who want downtown development over neighborhood development, right? So it's a series of real important political choices tied up in class and race that leads to this consequence, right? So Dream mentioned the Red Wing Stadium, and then you mentioned the new Red Wing Stadium, and you mentioned the two other stadiums. The total cost for Comerica Park, which is where the Tigers play, Ford Field, which is where the Lions play, and the new Red Wing Stadium, the total cost of subsidies is $500 million, right? That is a choice to give corporate forces on behalf of predominantly white middle and upper class consumers over the population that's in the city. And this narrative, again, you're starting to see, you see this narrative. Dream's been talking about it. Dave Zirin wrote a piece. I wrote a blog piece. And there are other people in the nation, others, writing pieces like this. But that other narrative, that 67 rebellion, black political dysfunction, et cetera, that narrative is something we have to push back against if we want to fight for the public.
Well, let me ask you all through this question. I want to listen to chime in here, 410-319-8888. Write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com, 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on Detroit, think about where you live. Maybe if you're living in D.C., if you're listening to us in New York, wherever you happen to be, if you're listening to us in any other community in Baltimore here where we're broadcasting from, what this says to other cities in America. And so because every city in almost every state in America are facing the same issues with the inability to pay for pensions, to pay for retirees, to invest money in schools. It's happening in every city across America. So is what we're seeing in Detroit something that we're going to see happening, a rollout in other cities? Or is this unique to Detroit because people like to say Detroit's a basket case? So who's that? I'm sorry, Sheila?
This is Dream. Yeah.
Dream, go ahead. Yeah.
Hey, I'd like to push back against this against that frame that there is an inability to pay the public pensions. What we're seeing is a choice not to pay them.
Yes.
And to award corporate subsidies, you know, like Lester just said, often to the tune of $500 million. I mean, Rhode Island, you're talking about $356 million a year in corporate subsidies. In Kentucky, you're talking about $1.4 billion as they slash pension benefits. So these are choices.
Yes.
By these rogue, you know, activist governors choosing corporations and Wall Street over the people who elected them. And, you know, often we see these Republican governors voted in by white folks who think that they're middle class, only to learn a few years later that they're as working class as, you know, the black people that they're trying to get all this distance from. But you've just seen a lot of people vote against their own personal interests, and these governors have basically handed over public pensions. And we talk about this like this is nothing, like a public pension is being slashed for these corporate subsidies to Wall Street companies like Curt Schilling. But these are people who gave, you know, I was born in the 70s. I had no hope of getting a job that will last me 3 decades. But like Sheila said, her parents, my parents.
My parents?
Yes, exactly. My dad, you know, he worked at a company that delivered school lunches in different capacities. He was a driver, a mechanic. He did different things for that company for 40 years until the day he died. He worked at that company. You know, these are people who gave their lives, who invested in everything that they were told. They did the right thing. You know, their pants weren't sagging. They wore belts.
They showed up to work on time.
And they are being robbed at their most vulnerable, in their old age. And we're about to deal with this silver wave. We're about to deal with a whole new generation, you know, coming onto these roles. Mm-hmm. And these politicians are handing their life savings over to rogue Wall Street companies.
Yeah. Sheila, you were about to say what?
Yeah, you know, I wanted to say a couple of things. And I do, you know, part of sort of my discourse has an international as well as a national flavor. And I think it's important to sort of look at the kind of schemas, the sorts of things that have been done internationally. For example, in South Africa, after President Mandela took office, one of the things that the country had to grapple with was they were in a huge economic disarray. And one of the things that happened with the WHO and the World Bank and all of these other sort of financial institutions, international institutions, was that they sold everything off, all the public assets, for pennies on the dollar. But the one thing that was maintained in South Africa, and I think this is really interesting, were the pensions for all the white white Afrikaners who had been the head of apartheid. So you're right. We see it that you know, that the political will to do whatever they want to do is there. They can make the determination. But the essential thing is that in Poland, we look at the Soviet Union or the former Soviet Union, all across the globe, we see this complete restructuring, reorganizing, and redistribution of wealth in order to make up for the fact that we are in an epoch of laborless production. And laborless production essentially means that people are no longer necessary in the production process in the same way that they were needed, and therefore the ruling class, the corporations, have to find other ways in order to create their wealth. We see this in the rapid trading that goes on in Wall Street. We see it in these takeovers, the absolute abysmal manner in which the housing crisis was handled. And with the complicit cooperation of our so-called elected officials. And because our history in this country, and indeed around the globe, has been so incredibly racialized, the ruling class is able to take the issue of race and just turn it on its head. In the 1940s, in cities like Detroit and D.C. and Baltimore in Oakland, it was the U.S. government that was forced to open its doors to African Americans and to employ them to develop what is clearly a modern black middle class in this country. It was through the, public sector jobs and the post office and et cetera that African Americans were brought into the mainstream. It certainly wasn't through private industry. And it's that...
Let's just jump in just real quick here for a minute before we go to break.
So you mentioned, so that idea of laborless production is incredibly important. And we're talking about Detroit. One of the first people to recognize that were the activists, Grace Boggs, that we've talked about a lot. But it was Jimmy Boggs, right? James Boggs, who moves from down south to work in Detroit. Him and Grace are recognize this as early as like the early 60s, not just the mid to late, like the early 60s, they realize what's coming. And the role of race in here that Sheila touches on is incredibly important because it's always easier, given the unique history of the United States, it's easier to tar a city or an individual like Trayvon or a population in general as being unworthy of public resources if they are not white, right? So we can imagine... So juxtaposing that against about the welfare, the desire for us to allow those predominantly black workers in Detroit to keep their pensions with the corporate welfare that we're giving to Mike Ilitch. Mike Ilitch is worth, I believe, $1 billion at least. He has the money to pay for
$2 billion.
Yeah, he has the money to pay for these stadiums, right? So what would be the argument to justify giving him that much money? But the way the narrative is structured, you don't even have to justify the argument, right? Whereas with black and poor people, now granted, it's two different dimensions, race and class, but with black and poor people, we have to consistently fight, right? Or with a city like Detroit or like Inkster or like Pontiac, you have to justify the right to self-govern, right? And that's the way that race works. It becomes far easier to make these moves when you're talking about black populations.
So, folks, we really do want you to join us here at 410-319-8888. We're going to read an email here that came in from Betty. Your thoughts on this, and I'm going to raise another question as soon as we come back from break here. Betty's question is, I'm listening to Lester Spence talk about Detroit, and it strikes me how similar this is to Baltimore. Could you ask Dr. Spence to comment?
So when people ask me, I was just walking home yesterday and I ran into a brother and I told him I was from Detroit and he asked me how I like Baltimore. I was like, the reason I like Baltimore is because it's Detroit on the East Coast, right? So a lot of the similar forces. Uh-huh. Now, it's not as hard hit as Detroit is because the East Coast is so dense that land, you're not going to let that land go fallow. Right. But you see the mayor making a number of the same types of political decisions in corporate wealth as far as corporate welfare as we see in Detroit.
So we're going to take a quick brief break and come back and get some calls here at 410-319-8888. And I'm going to jump into a question about what this says for the rest of the nation with our three guests. Stay with us as we continue our conversation on Detroit. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. Join us here at 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on Detroit and how it may affect your lives wherever you're living right now. We have Dr. Lester Spence in the house. He is Associate Professor of Political Science and Africana Studies at Johns Hopkins University, the Center for Emerging Media Scholar in Residence, and a Detroit native, Dream Hampton, cultural critic, writer, filmmaker, and feminist, co-author with Jay-Z of the New York Times bestseller Decoded, and now about to direct a film about the transgender teen who was slain in Detroit. We're looking forward to that piece of work as well. Sheila Garland Olaniron is with us, longtime political activist from Flint, Michigan, organizer with the National Nurses Union. As I said earlier, her children call her a political mama with a twinkle in her eye. 410-319-8888 is the number here. Before I get to the phones, I'm going to ask this, something I've been wrestling with since this began, looking at what happens to in Chicago with the school system, what is happening with the buying power of the American dollar and workers and middle-class people, everybody not being able to buy what they ever could before because wages are down, real dollars are down. Looking at this pension fund crisis that we're facing, is the issue that, partially, that capitalism as we know it today in this country can no longer answer the question?
Mark, I talk about that. This is true. I talk about that all the time. Capitalism is on its knees, and it is not being framed that way by the mainstream media in the same way that when the Berlin Wall fell, when Gorbachev finally ceded, that we talked about communism, the collapse of communism. Meanwhile, you know, China, the most populous country in the world and rising power, still remains, at least, you know, by political party, communist. So you have this narrative being floated about the collapse of communism, and people in this country and in the West in general, and this goes throughout Europe with their many, many crises, you know, Greece just being the kind of Detroit of Europe right now, refusing to frame it, refusing to call into question this kind of hyper-capitalism. I could get into, like, different conspiracy theories that, you know, we're looking at, you know, prisons as a new plantations, that the kind of capitalism that this country was founded on required 300 years of free labor. So, you know, we really do have a crisis around capitalism, and no one is willing to talk about it honestly in the mainstream press.
Yeah, and I would say that, this is Sheila, and, you know, I would just add to what Dream is saying, and that capitalism in its current form is certainly being reorganized by the ruling class. It's not, capitalism is not just going to die on its own. That is, and I think I want to just be very specific, the private ownership of public necessaries is essentially, you know, this requirement. With respect to its composition, that is capital, what makes it capitalism. But one of the requirements is the buying and selling of labor and, of course, the private ownership of property, of the means of production, as it were. And so those kinds of things, if those are not challenged directly, that is abolished as we abolish slavery, it will persist. It's not going to, I don't think, die on its own.
Well, I'm sorry. You finish. Are you finished?
Yeah, I just wanted to make one other point from the last our last discussion, and that is that I think that this whole notion that somehow the government, be it Republican represented or Democrat represented, is, you know, that there's a real distinction, and I just want to point out that here in Chicago and in Illinois, we have a supermajority of Democrats in the House. We have a Democratic mayor, Rahm Emanuel. We have a Democratic leadership at the county level. So everything is super Democratic. And yet and still, Illinois is faced with a pension crisis that is similar, in fact, bigger in scope than anything that's going on in the country right now. And the resolution for that is similar to what we see across the country, is the destruction of those pensions, forcing folks to take pay cuts or eliminate, you know, future pensions. You know, all the schemes, and it's all going on with the tacit agreement of the labor unions who are tied to the Democratic Party, who are tied to the ruling class through the Democratic Party. So, you know, I think we have to sort of have a narrative that looks at the entire corporate class and its agenda and how the government is really now owned in many respects by the corporations. I mean, obviously there are some politicians, many politicians, who strive for a measure of independence and the ability to do things, but their ability to get things done becomes increasingly less as you know, the chorus of, you know, corporate agenda marches forward.
So one thing I'd add to what Sheila said, which is brilliant, is that it's important to note that what we're talking about isn't just the rise of capital. It's a very peculiar type of capital, right? It's finance capital,
yeah.
Right? So back in when we were all younger, banks were just like utilities, right? They provided public services. But then what happens in the beginning of the 70s, and then it takes on another shape in the 90s, is it becomes its own thing to the point where it dwarfs manufacturing capital. And people are selling financial products that you can't actually touch. Like a derivative is marketed as a quote-unquote financial product, right? So we are talking about capitalism in general, but more specifically, we're talking about the rise of finance capital and then it dwarfing other forms. There's a moment where I believe with GM and Ford, well, I know with GM, where GM made more money through their financing wing than they did making cars.
So I have an email here from Jamal Hunt. Let me read it and let you all react to it in the 10 minutes or so we have left before we turn back to our continuing analysis of what Trayvon Martin means for America. Jamal Hunt wrote in, "One of the things I have noticed that no one wants to bring up, we're pretending that the city relied upon the auto industry too much during its best years when there was no international competition at all at one point. When the manufacturers left and went overseas, Detroit was slowly losing to where it is now. There was a lack of adapting to changes in the competitive market. You have amoral capitalists that don't give a hoot whom continue to get paid while the company is slowly running into the ground. You have a city where the majority of the city is of color, and for some reason there's no power structure by the people of color. Has integration truly improved the lives and mindset of people of color? What's the difference of sitting from the back of the bus to the front of the bus if the quality of the seats is the same? How did moving from a black neighborhood to a white neighborhood or from a black school to a white school improve black people's ownership and control of wealth and power? And why do people of color have to rely on the government and the church to save us again? Where's the economic power structure of blacks? You have no money, you have no say," writes Jamal Hunt.
You know, I think that he brings up a couple of good points. And one of them let's do
this one at a time. And we have like 7 or 8 minutes left, so we're going to jump here. Sheila, then Dream, and come back over to Lester.
Okay, I just wanted to say that I've heard this argument many, many times, but I think it's important to remember that, the situation that's going on in Detroit is while it's the appearance of it is that it's around further disenfranchising African Americans, but I think that folks should remember that this is a reflection of the revolution going on in the economy based on technology that replaces labor, and that we're going to see this playing itself out in different communities. In some of the Appalachian communities, the rates of poverty are almost at 90%, and those are all white. How do you explain that? I mean, they're completely disenfranchised. They don't participate in the vote. They don't own anything. They can't get anything. They're losing their pensions. They're losing everything. How do you explain that in this country if it's really only predicated on color? So I think that we do have to have a narrative about class and having a class agenda, that really talks about how do we secure power and move forward as a class. Because I just wanted to say one thing. When Clinton passed welfare as we knew it, that set the bar so low that no one in this country, I don't care if you were black or white, immigrant, non-immigrant, we're seeing that played out. You were not going to be able to go to the government and get what you needed in a time of economic crisis in your life, and this is what we're seeing. It's that equalization of poverty that sets the groundwork or sets the basis for a political agenda based on class that includes a fight around the issues of color and race in this country. But without having that understanding, we'll just constantly have a divisive discussion, and this plays in the hands of the ruling class. As long as the working class is divided, how do we get together to do anything about this thing?
Dream, your take, and then
Sheila is so brilliant.
Yeah, she is, isn't she? Yes, she's dope. Like, wow, okay.
I mean, you know, I'm proud to come from a city that was basically ground zero for labor rights organizing, often, like Lester said, by black people like James Boggs, black-led labor organizing. Detroit is a place, a black space that nurtured so many of us. So much of this talk is about, the subtext of this is about black incompetence. And I look forward to very soon writing about how nurtured and how full I was growing up under, like, Coleman Young, under black leadership and in all black spaces. They weren't integrated at all. I mean, by the time I come around in the 70s, white people had fled in Detroit. They called it a, 83% black city, but it was the only white person left in Detroit was my mother. So this wasn't an integrated city. This was an all black city, and it was a beautiful thing. Like, what we're losing and what we've lost is so much. I could talk about the auto industry and the choices that they made. You know, they get bailed out for this too big to fail. but they made ridiculous, macho, hyper-masculine decisions to continue to produce these gas-guzzling SUVs when the entire world said they wanted a Honda Accord. And who paid for that? Unions, and getting their, you know, coming back to the table again and again, making concessions, the workers. But what we know now is that mass employment is not coming back to Detroit. You know, Shea Howe wrote about that. We're at the end of the, who's also from the Grace Lee Boggs Center, we're at the end of the industrial job system, she says, and at the beginning of developing new kinds of work that enable us to produce goods and services for local ideas, ideas of a new work and a new culture rooted in local production and consumption and emerging throughout the city. And that's what I look forward to.
Oh, I'm sorry, Jamie. We only have like 4 minutes left in the segment. I want to let's get a final thought in.
Yeah, so the final thought is, so Dream really hits that. I mean, so I really don't believe in Du Bois' concept of double consciousness. But one of the reasons I don't is because I didn't live it. I did not live it because I grew up in and around Detroit, where I saw black people do. I saw black people as gangsters, black people as property owners, black people as politicians, black people did everything. I was surrounded and enveloped in blackness, right? And that blackness, we don't talk enough about that. Real quickly, though, the argument that what we need to basically do is have our own economy, it ignores the interdependency. We're not independent, we're interdependent. Then also ignores the importance of politics. Right. So Detroit becomes a poster child in part because of political decisions that are made that give whites access to property and take that access away from Detroit. And to the extent we can talk about solutions, not only to the extent that we're creating spaces for new economic ideas, those new economic ideas are going to be on the are going to is going to be very difficult to institutionalize those economic ideas, those economic alternatives without politics. So one of the benefits, one of the things that's recently happened in Detroit is Detroit is now about to elect city council members by district rather than at large. And to the extent that we can talk about building in mechanisms of accountability, it's going to be far easier to hold city council members accountable and make them push the mayor, right, when they're elected from a specific neighborhood rather than when they're all supposed to be elected to cover the city as a whole.
Well, what I'd like to do is, soon we have to break in and go to our next topic, is really invite you all back as Lester and I begin to produce this series here with our producers, Detroit, Baltimore, Oakland, to really get this up. Detroit, Baltimore, Oakland, to get this conversation rolling about all the issues the three of you just raised at the end here, which I think are critical to the formation of a conversation and dialogue about the future. I really appreciate the time all of you have taken. Sheila Garland Olin-Iron, first time on the show. Great to have you with us, organizer for National Nurses Union. Sheila, thanks so much for being part of the show. You contributed a great deal. It was great.
Thank you so much, Mark. And it was a pleasure getting to know on the radio Lester and Dream, and I look forward to having more conversation and discourse with you all.
Thank you. And Dream Hampton, it's always great to have you with us, and we're looking forward to this new film, A Transparent, A Story of a Loss and Community Misunderstood, about the brutal murder of transgender woman Treasure Hilliard in Detroit. And we really look forward to that work that you come out with and continuing your presence on our show. Dream, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mark.
And Lester, we're going to hang out for a minute, and we're going to come back and talk to Michael Denzel Smith, the Nobler Fellow at the Nation Institute at Nation.com, about his article on Trayvon Martin.
Hey, quickly, I want to give a shout out to Dream. We've been like Facebook friends for a while. I also wanted to give a shout out to my Detroit listeners. I will be back there in 2 weeks. That's what's up. I will be back. What? It's on.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.